Good afternoon, and the tax committee will come to order. We don't have a quorum yet, so Representative Simpson, let's just get started. We can't move your amendment or move the bill yet. We don't have a quorum, but Representative Simpson, I want you to know I feel terribly that I'm not wearing green today. I really goofed up, and I'm glad you are. My mom's name is Patty McGraw, and she would be furious with me if she could see that I'm not wearing green right now. So I'm glad you did. And Representative Simpson is going to introduce for us the governor's tax proposals this year. And as soon as we have a quorum, we'll move the amendments that Representative Simpson needs to get this in the order he would like it. So with that, welcome Representative Simpson, Commissioner Inez, and Assistant Commissioner Manson.
Well, thank you, Madam Speaker. Top of the morning to you, or afternoon, I guess. We have House File 3967 before us, and we will have an amendment when we do have a committee, enough people to pass it off. So basically, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the easy way out. I'm going to let the professionals go through this section by section and explain it to you, and we'll take questions as we after we present the bill or however you like to do it, would like to do it.
Thank you. Mr. Inez.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ward Inez, representing the Department of Revenue. And before I delve into the tax bill, I wanted to take the 20 seconds to talk about, first and foremost, to thank this committee and the chair for passing 3201. And we have, in furtherance of that, the federal conformity fight of maybe the most time-sensitive piece of that bill. And by acting fairly promptly, you probably saved about 1.5 million taxpayers from having to wrestle with the brain buster of a storm called the M1CR or whatever. So we've cost about a million tax returns so far. We expect another 1.5 million. And fortunately, we got the new forms up online now. We've notified the software preparers, we've notified the practitioners, working with the VITA site to inform them of the changes and make sure they got the appropriate forms. And so about one and a half million. So, you know, the majority of taxpayers will hopefully avoid having to wrestle with that form. And I think it's a good thing for taxpayers in general and just good tax policy. So I want to thank you. You were a tireless advocate in getting that passed before it was too late. So thank you.
Well, and Commissioner Inez, I thank you as well. And I thank all the minority members, majority members, and both partisan staff and our House Research and Fiscal staff, because it's really this room who got how important that was, and to try to convince everybody else in the big room why it mattered. So it really was an effort. We all had to, you know, do our role till we got to the final place where the governor could sign it. But I think it really is important that the tax committee, no matter which party is in the majority, always makes conformity a priority. And I think we've lost a little ground on that in the last few years, and we need to rectify that so that we can go back to the years where bipartisan, it didn't matter who was the tax chip, conformity always got done. So I thank you for that, too.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll just kind of go through the bill in the order of the, in order, I guess. Sections 1 and 8.
Excuse me, Commissioner Inez, are you working off the governor's tax bill summary? What are we looking at right now?
That's probably the easiest thing to work off of. I actually got my own talking points.
Okay.
But it goes in order of the bill for
okay.
the most part. And so, you know, Sections 1 and 8 are relating to a compliance proposal that we're proposing called the, in shorthand we call it the Tax Debtor Data Map. And this is modeled after the DHS. DHS is a similar tool at their disposal for hotel support obligations that are owed. And you also know that a number of other states have implemented a program like this for tax obligations that are owed. And essentially how it would work is we would exercise a lien on a tax debt. And then that lien, the information in that lien would go to the financial institution in an encrypted, secured form, and they would confirm to us whether that individual had an account at that financial institution. So it would be easier for us to attach the lien. Our current process is much more time-consuming and labor-intensive. What we do is we get a lien, and usually a lien is only attached to those obligations of $1,500 or greater. We would not use this tool for small to minimum amounts. It would be for larger tax obligations. And then we try to determine where there may be assets. And oftentimes, that's a fairly labor-intensive process. And then we send a letter to the financial institution saying, this taxpayer has a tax lien, name, address, social security number, and then they confirm whether that taxpayer has an account at their institution. This would be electronic file that we would send. We'd send it quarterly to the financial institution, and they would confirm whether there was a policy or an account at their financial institution. So a much more, what we think, efficient way of trying to satisfy these tax liens. We think it would raise about $10 million a year, the baseless numbers on what some other states have collected when they've imposed this this tool. Maryland is the one we've had most communication with, and it's been a very successful tool. In Maryland, Kentucky is also has something similar. About five or six other states are in the process of pursuing this, California being the largest state. For the most part, much of the language is adopted from what we do currently for DHS.
Thank you, Ms. Commissioner. Just a moment, if I might. We have a quorum, Representative Simpson. So Representative Simpson, this is House File 3967. And Representative Simpson, what's your amendment you want to move?
I would, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the 808-1321 amendment.
Okay, and that's just to get in the order the author would like, as we're discussing the amendment. If not, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Amendment's adopted with one vote. You know, the tax committee we forgot what it's like to be in here. We've let everyone do their work. We were so busy passing that early bill that now we have to get started.
Exactly.
We have to get our groove back. I also want to just take a minute, if I can, and ask that Representative Zellers move the minutes of February 26th. Would that be all right?
Don't move, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that. Discussion of the minutes. All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The minutes are adopted. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Simpson.
Just to the amendment, due to the fact you're the only one that's paying attention, what it did was straighten out, they pulled all the things out of 3201 that we've already passed. So that's what we're doing. If we were to redo 3967, it would be about half the size it is. So
yes, and that's a great point. Thanks for that, Representative Simpson. There are quite a few provisions, members, that the governor proposed that we have already adopted in our first tax bill. A lot of things that we needed to bring into compliance, but to this first section that you just went through, Commissioner Innes, am I right? This provision, this $10 million in revenue, will be carried by state of finance in the tax compliance spot, or is that, where are you guys looking at that? Are you going to go to a Representative Cons committee with that as well?
Madam Chair, we just appeared in front of Senator Gutzel's committee in the Senate, and they did confirm to me that they were carrying this in their budget bill. I don't know if the health side of the equation has made that determination, but I know...
I think that's where we'd like it as well. So I think Representative Kahn would, you know, want to be apprised of that. She'll probably think she can get a little more out of you than 10, but...
Maybe. I think that's a conservative number.
Okay. Thank you.
Moving on, Section 2, 3, and 4 are another what I would define as a compliance initiative, and it's the creation of a non-profit, non-government stamping office. And to process what we call non-surface line insurance policy. Other states have implemented a stamping office for this nature. Basically, I didn't know anything about non-surface lines of insurance until we started vetting this in the department. But those are the insurance policies that oftentimes, most often, you cannot get it domestically, cannot get it in Minnesota. There are things, there's unique insurance such as carnival rides or hot air balloon insurance, NASCAR insurance, terrorism insurance, things that oftentimes you cannot secure in the domestic insurance market. The stamping office will be created. It will be funded exclusively by stamping fees. There will be no state dollars to fund the stamping office. And it will require every insurance policy, surplus insurance policy, to be stamped pursuant to this office, and then that information would be sent to the Department of Commerce and also the Department of Revenue, so we'd have a much better idea about how much surplus line insurance is being sold here in Minnesota, who sold it, so we can make sure that the appropriate amount of premium tax is being collected. Currently, we collect about $12 million a year in the premium tax. We think this will bring in an additional $3 million, so about 25% increase in the insurance premium tax. If you look at the other states that instituted the stamping office, and they've had their compliance go up for this tax anywhere from 20% to 300%. So we're on a fairly conservative side. We think that's a pretty solid estimate. Moving on, Sections 5 through 47 are changes to the Job V program. And if you have some more questions regarding these changes, I can bring up some more friends from Deed to answer them. But essentially what this does is it extends the program. Not the sunset that state would stay in effect. Currently the program scheduled to sunset 2015. That would stay into effect. But any subsidy agreement that was signed from now until 2015 would have either a 10-year duration or a 12-year duration. 10-year would be the general rule, and then there'd be an allowance for a 12-year job fee duration if the community met a couple of other criteria. And you can see here, it's called a targeted rural opportunity community for that 12-year time period. And it'd be a city and a county that lost population from 1980 to 2000, or had an unemployment rate higher than the state average based on 2006 numbers. So kind of a bifurcated job fee program is what it would be. 10 years would be the general rule. You get up to 12 years if you're one of these few communities that would qualify for this. I think the cost of that would be about the extension would be $300,000 in 2009, $900,000 in 2010, and $1.8 in 2011. The next section 628 proposes a regional emerging business investment tax credit. This is similar to what was in the bill last year. So I think we morphed it into a grant, but out of the same criteria of this emerging tax credit. Once again, the folks in Beaver administer this program for the most part. So if you have any questions about this, I'll be happy to bring them up at a later time here.
Excuse me. Whose bill was this last year? Was it one of the bills? There were a number of bills out there like this. I think Dabney and Mahoney and... Is this identical to anybody's bill last year? Or is this a new thing?
Madam Chair, it would not be identified. Nobody worked in the interim to change it, but you are correct, Madam Chair. There were many iterations of this basic concept. And I know that in the interim we did work on changing it, so it's a little bit different. But it has the same, the Commissioner of Deed would certify these different certified these funds, and it's capped at $3 million. They would give out certificates to each one of the funds in order to make these eligible to qualifying investments. So it's just similar to what we vetted the last couple of years. Yeah. Section 7.
Excuse me, Commissioner Ina, prep them or fire them.
Chair members, there's been a lot of complaints about that. That people move from the south side to the north side of town and you've got to get it, et cetera. Are you cleaning that up in the
Commissioner, Madam Chair, Representative Wolfhauser, there is another bill that we think goes a long way towards addressing a lot of the findings in the legislative audit report. And and that bill is being carried by Senator Rosen in the Senate.
And Representative Mark.
And Representative Mark Ford in the House. And I think that goes a long way to addressing a lot of the deficiencies that the legislative auditor pointed out. I think one of the most important things that's in Representative Mark Ford's bill is that one of the biggest shortcomings I think we found is that the reporting from the local units of government to the state to determine whether people are in compliance with their subsidy agreement, whether they're making the number of jobs that they created, the number of jobs they said they would create, and also whether they're reaching the wage thresholds that they promised the subsidy agreement, was really not as good as we needed it to be. So one of the key provisions in Representative Mark Cord and Senator Rosen's bill is that it would require an annual certification by the business, the benefiting business, to say, yes, we are in compliance with both the job creation goal and the wage goal. Failure to submit that drops them from the program, or to materially misrepresent whether they're in compliance or not, which drops them from the program. I think one of the shortcomings we did have before was that there wasn't enough speed as far as reporting to make sure we get the right information in order to exercise our callback authority to eliminate a business from the job fee program. So I think much of what's in Representative Marquardt will go a long way for addressing that. The relocation issue, I think it's still a real issue for some folks. But we did change the requirements for a relocation to make the bar higher. And since we made that change, I think it was in 2005, we have seen far fewer relocations of the kind you mentioned, just within a community. Because now they got to create more jobs, they got to create more capital investment. And that took away a lot of the incentive to just kind of do the game, kind of shuffle the boxes. So I think we've addressed that to a large extent. But I think the reporting requirements and other things that are in the Marquardt bill will go a long way for making the program, fulfilling its promise.
Representative Markford.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say what basically the commissioner said. There is a bill out there, which I'm carrying, that addresses the concerns we've had in the past and also from the Office of Legislative Auditor, so we'll probably be seeing that later.
Thank you.
Section 7, 17, 19, and 53 eliminate the political contribution refund in its entirety. I know back in, I think it was 2003, the governor recommended a 50% reduction in this credit. This year he is recommending complete elimination. And that raises about $5.4 million in the first year, $5.7 and $6.8. We process about $100,000 of political contribution refunds per year to the Department of Revenue. Sections 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14 are the levy limit section. We had a very thorough and a robust discussion of the property tax division on it. And these levy limits, to a large extent, are similar to the past levy limits. A couple of important distinctions, but they apply to cities and counties with a population over 2,500, which is under that, about 224 cities would come under the purview of these levy limits in all 87 counties. All the special levies that have been in previous levy limits would be included in these. There's about 13 special levies, include debt service levies, unreimbursed costs of natural disasters, operations and maintenance of qualified county jails. There's a whole laundry list of the special levies. Those would all be outside the levy limit. The major distinction here is that the levy limit base is not levy plus aid as it has been traditionally. It is the levy. And so we thought that was important to put taxpayers in both aid-dependent cities and non-aid-dependent cities on the same playing field. And so the levy limit is the levy limit base is levy, not levy plus aid. It also still retains the ability to exceed the levy limit if you take the issue to the voters. If you want to go above your levy limit and you have a compelling case to make, you can take it to the voters and exceed the levy limit. We did a run of this. This levy limit had been in place for taxes payable in 2008. And if this levy limit had been in place, the property tax increase statewide would have gone from 7.3% to 5.4%. So there still would have been fairly healthy levy increases, but it would have tamped down some of those increases. Federal conformity sections have been removed from the bill and going to the passage of 3301. The next section, 16, 18, 45, and 46, are related to joint accelerated payment. As you know, the Health Style 3201 that passed, we went from 78 to 80. This would take it up to 85%. Sections 20, 24, 25, and 52 are the FOC provisions. And the language that's included in here is exactly the same language that was included in the bill that was vetoed by the governor last year. So I always talk about it as compromise language on the FOC. And that raises $102 million in FY09, 80.5 in 2010, and 83.6 in 2011. Section 23.
Excuse me. When you say the FOC provision is the same as the veto tax bill, this is, but it's minus the spending components that went with that compromise. The ramping up single cell apportionment, that kind of stuff.
That is correct. That, Madam Chair, that's a good point. The only thing we retained in this was we do increase the royalty subtraction from 80% to 90%. But the single sales, we did not include the single sales as part of that. Correct, Madam.
Thank you. And Representative Wolfgang.
Chair, members, commissioners, my understanding of this is that since we've been talking about this for, I don't know, how many years, long before I came here, that you're now seeing more compliance. Is that true?
Gotcha.
Madam Chair, Representative Wolfrager, I can't make a definitive statement on that. I think what we've seen is that when we made a change in 2005, one of the changes made in 2005 was to make sure that they had some physical economic presence overseas. So we would put in the threshold for $1 million in payroll and $2 million in property, and we did see an uptick on questions pursuant to that. I can't say definitively. I could go back and talk to our corporate folks and see if they, go back to compliance. I mean, compliance, I mean, they're in compliance with the law as it currently stands. We may quibble about whether that's the appropriate way an FOC should be used and whether that was the original intent of the FOC. But I think most taxpayers who are using the FOC are probably in compliance with current status of the law. I think what this change does is reaffirm the original intent of the FOC. This is what it really was intended to do. I just want to say, I think most taxpayers are in compliance with the current KA.
Commissioner, I mean, there's some more fire.
I guess where I'm coming from is that I've looked at earlier numbers that said, you know, if you crack down on FOC, we would get a savings of like $300 million, and now it's down to $100 million. So I'm just trying to figure out, how did we move from 300 to 100? I mean, we're either greater compliance or something else has changed.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Wallfather, those higher numbers were attributable to a couple things. One thing was the effective date that the Senate, I think mainly the Senate was using, I don't know if the House was actually tax year 2007. So by losing a year because it's been enacted, that lost $100 million from the first year revenue estimate. So I think that was a major adjustment, is that the Senate was saying a number that took effect for tax year 2007. This takes effect for tax year 2008. That 100-year lag loses $100 million. So you go from 220 to 105. Yep. Section 23 is the military pension and pay subtraction. And similar to what we proposed in the past, and it stays as it is over 4 years, up to a maximum subtraction of $30,000. Section 30 and 31.
I'm sorry, I apologize. Did you say that's both the pay and the pension? What you're on section 23?
Right.
So that's the on the revenue estimate, that's two lines?
It is two lines. So it's two, a little over $11 million.
That's smaller than last year?
It is. You know, last year's proposal was a full exemption, but a maximum of $30,000. I think that's the primary difference. This is scaled back, not a 100% exemption.
So he's listening.
We always listen. Of course. Now, it's a different economic time now. We cannot afford today. So. That's section 23. Section 30 and 31 is a change in the way we apportion mutual fund income. This was an idea that was vetted, I think, late in session last year by Representative Dabney. The language is not identical to what Representative Dabney proposed. Basically gets us to the same place. And currently, mutual fund income is apportioned based on where the mutual fund is located. And this would apportion it based on where the customers are. This has been a national trend. We see more and more states going to this apportionment methodology. I know Illinois, New York, a lot of the big states, California, have already adopted this form of apportionment. We thought Representative Dabney made a very compelling case, and we've included in governor's recommendation. It has a cost of about $2 million a year. The next section was deleted from the bill. Section 32 was withholding on contractors. Sections 33 and 34 is an adjustment in the renter's credit. We are proposing going from 19% on the renter's credit. Right now the renter's credit is a presumed percent of rent paid to property taxes. That current percentage is 19%. We're recommending going to 16%. And that recommendation is predicated on a Department of Revenue analysis that was done in 2005. That concluded that the appropriate percent of rent paid is probably somewhere 15% or less, based on that analysis. I think it's worth noting that in 2001 there was some dramatic property tax relief provided, and one of the classes of property that got the most property tax relief was rental property. I think about 24% reduction. But at that point, we never recalibrated the renter's credit. The renter's credit was stayed at 19%, I believe, for the last 10 years. even though there's been changes in property tax burdens and deductions for rental property, we haven't recalibrated the renter's credit. So in essence, the renter's credit has become a property tax relief program, but also a rent subsidy program to some individuals. So we think in order to maintain the integrity of that program, it makes sense to recalibrate the renter's credit or more appropriately reflect the percent of rent paid. Let's see, the streamlined sections have all been removed from the bill. Sections 41 and 44 is the sales tax reduction. The 1/8 of 1% reduction in the general sales tax rate. That'll have a revenue impact of about $76 million in the first year, $87 million in the second, and $90 million in the third year. And then Sections 49, 50, and 51 are the governor's recommendations regarding the utility transition aid. This is essentially the same thing the governor recommended last year. It said any community that lost more than 5% of its tax capacity will be eligible for transition aid. This is a two-year transition aid to kind of provide a shock absorber to those communities that were more disproportionately impacted by the change in utility valuation rule.
And Brian, just a moment. That's some Wolfiner. Chair, members, Commissioner, you know, why is the state of Minnesota subsidizing the utility companies via utility transition aid?
That's right. Madam Chair, representing the Wolfiner, I don't view it as subsidizing the utilities. What the utilities did was they went in and they exercised their right that every taxpayer has to challenge their valuation on their property. They succeeded in that challenge. They won at the tax court level. We also brought an impartial person in to analyze our rule to see if it was legally deficient. Both the court and the third party ruled that it was legally deficient. We were compelled, really legally compelled, to change the valuation rule. We've done that. And we think we understood.
Yeah, no.
We understood that it would have an impact on the whole community. One reason why we phased in the effect of the rule, and it's the reason why we're providing some transition aid. But I think the focus on the fact that these are utilities, but they are taxpayers who exercise their right to challenge their valuation, and they succeeded. And I think it's a questionable policy to come back and say, well, you may have succeeded by exercising your rights in the evaluation, but we're going to make sure there's no net gain to you by increasing, permanently increasing the class rate. We think it's more appropriate to provide some temporary relief to those host communities and give us some time to adjust to the change in valuation.
Yeah, that's from Wolfiner.
Chair, members, well, in effect, what you're doing here is a piecemeal fashion because you're putting in place provisions for basically 2 years for many cities. And in fact, you know, no surprise here that I'm against this, but I'm against it because it's not a good state policy. And in fact, I represent the city that has a deal for 10 years. And I don't think it's right that one city gets a deal for 10 years and all the other cities get a deal for 2 years. And so, you know, in effect, I'm almost speaking out against my own city, but for a statewide policy, it's piecemeal, and I don't think it's right.
Mr. Ines, are there other cities besides Red Wing that aren't getting this part of this provision?
I understand Red Wing is the only one that would qualify under the 5% in lost tax capacity that is entered into agreement with one of the utilities.
So, Commissioner, is it you signed an RSA and you lost more than 5? Yeah. What's the criteria here?
Yeah, it is. It's if you've lost more than 5% of your tax capacity due to the utility valuation rules change.
Okay.
And then you get a dollar-for-dollar replacement for anything above 5% of your lost levy plus pay. So you have to absorb that first 5% of loss, levy plus pay, but anything above that is replaced dollar for dollar for 2 years.
Okay, Commissioner, I asked, because I have to say when I first heard what was in the governor's bill, I mean, it seemed punitive to Red Wing. I was trying to figure out, you know, I mean, we know there's been a lot of battle with Representative Wolfiger fighting for her community and the utilities here, and I would sure hope that there's no intention to single out a member who's fighting for their community.
No, Madam Chair, and that's kind of all said, I can assure you, I mean, the language, to us, it has to do with whether it was Red Wing or any other community. the goal of our this transition aid was to help those who are most adversely disproportionately impacted. The fact that Red Wing had entered into a voluntary entered into a contract that may have not held them completely harmless, but actually, you know, they had entered into a contract. It didn't seem like it made sense to also give them replacement aid under this scenario.
Well, Commissioner, I just have to disagree with you there because it feels to me like it does feel punitive, and I just want you to know why. I think that if it's a good safe policy, it's just a good safe policy, regardless of what two private groups are doing with one another, in this case the city and the utility. I mean, for example, if it was a good state policy to not provide property tax relief, and then we were going to come in and give property tax relief to residents, we wouldn't say, you know, you qualify at this income level, but you have the same income level. You don't because you have a rich uncle, and he gave you some money. I mean, we don't, state doesn't get involved in private entities' agreements in general in tax policy. So I'm just really not understanding why. It just does feel punitive to me. And it seems that the RSA agreement between Red Wing and the utility should be ignored in the state tax policy decision making.
Okay. Madam Chair, it certainly wasn't meant to be punitive. I mean, we look at the 10-year agreement that Red Wing has entered into with itself as essentially a 10-year replacement aid agreement. So to give them this replacement aid on top of that seemed like, I don't want to say double dipping, but it seemed like you have an agreement that does take care of it for a longer period of time in these communities, a 10-year replacement aid agreement, yeah. And it didn't seem necessarily appropriate to say, okay, you'll get that replacement aid, but also you're going to get this additional $800,000 a year for 2 years.
Sorry to I'm sorry to just spend this much time on it, but I think the difference, just so you know where I'm coming from, Commissioner Ines, the difference is in this scenario, this tax provision is state taxpayers' money being given to these other communities, recognizing that as the whole city is there doing us all a favor. And the RSA agreement, it's utility money. So it's really not quite the same. And you can argue it's utility ratepayers, but certainly not every Minnesotan is in that bucket and is affected differently. So I guess I do see a difference in the universe of where the money is coming from. I just wanted you to know my thoughts on that. Representative Wolfmeyer.
Chair, members, Commissioner. You know, I could have had the city of Red Wing come here today because, you know, they feel very strongly that they were under duress, and that's why they signed it. And, you know, they have testified in favor of the utility classification rate because, again, they see it as a statewide policy and issue versus a local city. So I want to say that. I don't know. We're just going to disagree on this. And I do want to let you know that Representative Lentesky asked me not to go back to 1905 because that's where I wanted to go with, you know, there's been so many piecemeal issues over the years with utility classification, and that's one of the reasons why utilities became regulated, is because that was the fashion of utility companies for years and years and years, was to, you know, break off a certain city, make a deal with them, and pretty soon, you know, it was not only piecemeal throughout the state, but throughout the nation. So I'm not going back to 1905 today, but I could.
Madam Chair, you know, I know our proposal isn't going to be the final word on this issue, and I know it's important to not only your community, but all of other communities. And I know in Representative Marquardt's committee, open up the possibility, continue to talk about another option. This may not, doesn't do anything for everything, I understand that. But I know this isn't the final word, and I want to work with the committee and yourself and your community to make sure we do something that mitigates the tax impact as much as possible without doing anything, I hope, permanently, disadvantageous to the neutral result. I mean, we have to strike some kind of balance. Maybe it's not just different, maybe the appropriate balance. We need to strike some kind of balance.
Right.
I just want to...
Representative Wolfmeyer, yes.
Well, to be clear, Commissioner, I want to make it perfectly clear. I'm pro-insulator, and I have been for a long time. I'm a chemist by trade. And, you know, as I look forward, if we have any notion that we're going to place another nuclear facility in Minnesota, we need to think about this, because there isn't another city alive that's going to take a nuclear plant in Minnesota without any type of tax benefit. So, you know, let's think about this today and also the future.
Thank you. Hey, Commissioner Ines, I think you have one section left. Is that it? Are we through?
Yeah, the regular section.
At least with... Yeah, well, let's hear it all. Because I think we'd like to walk through the spreadsheet, too, when we're done.
I think
that's it? Okay.
That's the very clear of the thing on political contribution refund.
Okay, and then, Mr. Innes, I did make a request of your office to discuss the fees that the governor is proposing throughout his budget, and I know there's the mutual fund one. If you have information for us on that, lifting of the cap, there's really, due to the tax versus fee legislation, this is the committee that's going to deal with that. There's the public safety fees, and there's fishing fees that I'm aware of, and this is the committee that has to deal with those. So we had requested that all the fees be discussed in this committee today.
You know, we may be at a disadvantage here. I'm not sure we have anybody that's coming, the public safety.
Okay.
But I can talk about the mutual fund.
Okay.
Cap. In current law, I know the number is, but current law is a cap on mutual funds. Anything above that cap is distributed back to the mutual fund companies that on a pro rata basis based on their sales and what they paid in. This would essentially would eliminate the cap. I think it generates about $12 million. And there's a number in front of me.
Commissioner, is this a higher number than last year's proposal that the governor had? And then we had it in the bill, and I think it was wrongly carried in the energy bill because it kind of came through the process late. But is it the same dollar amount?
It's exactly the same proposal.
Okay.
It may be a different dollar
okay.
amount based on updated revenue
estimates. Okay. And public, Rep. Ben Paulson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Innes. I just want to follow up because I think we had some lengthy discussion last session on this issue, right? Is this the same issue? I know Representative Earhart and others had some strong concerns about this, and we may not have prevailed, I think, as the bill went forward, but just want to recollect, I mean, why we're sort of maybe going, hashing through this once again. I'm not convinced it's the right direction to go, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Mr. Innes.
Madam Chair, Senator Paulson, you're right, we did have some lengthy conversations on this. You know, a lot of tough decisions were made when putting together this budget proposal. And one of the reasons why I think we're thinking about doing changing the apportionment on the mutual funds is to kind of maybe offset some of the impacts of this mutual fund fee cap elimination. But it's been a lot of tough decisions, and we had to make decisions within the context of this budget, the tax area. Do we cut LGA? Do we cut market value credit? Do we cut CCR? Do we cut, a property tax refund? And when you start weighing the options, the mutual fund fee cap removal wasn't ideal, but it was better than some of the other options that were at our disposal. And that really is where how it came about. And I know that committee vetted it thoroughly last year. I think it made it into the tax bill, actually, right? I think it was in the tax bill last year. But I think there's still those Representative Paulson that take issue with the policy, whether it's appropriate policy or not. But we were confronted with some difficult decisions, and one of the things we did want to do, we wanted to hold LGA and market value credit and those things harmless. Thought that was a higher priority than the mutual fund. Typical trade-off.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Well, we're back into, is it a fee or is it a tax? You're increasing the burden on taxpayers. That's as simple as that. So we're going to hide behind whether it's a fee or a tax again. The governor doesn't want to raise taxes, and now we're back into doing the fees. Isn't there some more cigarette fees in here somewhere?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, I'm not aware of any other cigarette fees. This is always been referenced as a fee. It isn't tax, a fee that's paid. It's fee tax. I don't have that discussion anymore. It's set up with itself. It's a revenue raiser, and it raises, I think, somewhere around $15 million. Is it ideal? No. Is it better than the other options that were presented to you? Yes. I think I'd rather lift the cap on the mutual fund fees and eliminate local government aid. And that's just me, but I think that's a rational choice.
Well, I mean, you're being more selectively in your slaughter here than you are if you go against all of the local government aid folks that receive that. You're picking on a very narrow base of people who are investing in their future, for the retirement, for their kids, and picking on them rather than all the associate local government in. I mean, that's as simple as that. Just bald-faced stealing again.
No comment?
I'll stipulate to that. Yeah, we are.
Correct.
But that's his presentation.
Further questions? You know, Commissioner, I do think we should have a little discussion about the levy limits.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just tell us, really, what's up with that? I mean, it's... I hope that's not a very serious proposal, and I know the governor doesn't make, you know, he's serious in his proposals. Please don't take that as you know, that I think he's disingenuous. But you know, this committee is pretty much bipartisanly kind of beat those back year after year, and we've got a lot of local former local elected officials on both sides now, and they understand the true restraint that puts on cities. And I guess this levy limit is particularly objectionable. I mean, it really is taking a kind of a double hit to the LGA cities by not allowing them to include the aid. And, you know, I think at the same time, if I understand it, I don't, you know, I'm not on the Health and Human Services Committee and I'm not on public safety, but my understanding is there's a attempt to shift some more mandates and costs onto these local units of government, and then at the same time, we're not going to let them levy, and, oh, if you get LGA, then you really get stung. Can you just explain to us, you know, is this sort of a way to say if our property tax is not going up? I mean, I'm not understanding why this is really in part of the governor's proposal this year, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, the governor has been a strong advocate of levy limits, and we have proposed, I think, a levy limit almost every year that he's been governor. And we've tried every iteration of a levy limit possible. Last year we tried one that was really geared towards only those cities that had a high proportion of local government aid. We tried a broader approach back in 2003 or 4. And all of those have been met with a lot of resistance from this committee and other committees. We understand that, but he is a sincere believer in one of the only effective tools for holding down property taxes is a levy limit. And in the context of a budget where we did not LJ was not reduced, county aids were not reduced, market size credit was not reduced, he thought it was manageable for the city to have some sort of levy limit in place, especially at a time where it's extenuating economic circumstances, where people are struggling with other costs associated with their home ownership. We thought putting some kind of a reasonable cap, it allows for inflation, it allows for household growth, it allows for all the special levies that have traditionally been in place, and it also allows you to go over the levy limit if you can make a compelling case to your voters. So I don't think this is an onerous or draconian levy limit, and especially in due to the fact that we did not make any cuts in some of those other state aid programs, we thought this was doable. And we also thought the fact that putting on a levy limit basically made a good point. It could be viewed as, you know, maybe being punitive to LGA cities, but this levy limit was put in place from the perspective of the taxpayer. And the governor, you know, putting a taxpayer, whether you reside in a LGA-dependent city or a city like Edina doesn't get any LGA, taxpayers should be treated the same, and this proposal does that. If we were cutting LGA or cutting county aid, I think you can make a compelling argument that they should at least be allowed to recoup that lost aid to their levy, but since we weren't doing that, we think this is a fair and reasonable way of at least providing some minimal level of state protection for taxpayers, especially during a time when they're struggling with a lot of other economic issues. This is one thing we can put a little bit of a security blanket around the property tax. That was the thought that went into this level.
Okay. Further questions for the commissioner? If not, we have a number of people who'd like to testify on the bill. I don't know if they're for or against. Represent Marquardt Court.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I didn't know if we were going to go over the spreadsheet first or not, but we had. So, well, no, we're on levy limits. We had a pretty good discussion in property taxes the other day on levy limits, so I'm not going to go into that extent, but just to show that there is a huge difference between county levy plus aid or just covering levy. And, you know, I know Commissioner, you talk about creating a level playing field, and it's a level playing field if you totally ignore the fact that there are differences in property wealth among cities. And the fact that there are is the reasons why we have local government aid, which is the great equalizer. So to take local government aid out of the equation when you look at levy limits is ignoring the fact that you have these differences. And it's so that we have one Minnesota, so that in Dilworth, I will pay roughly the same amount to feel safe in my home as you would in Eagan. And that's basically the difference. And just for members, how that works, I had a sheet of paper the other day, I'm not going to pass that around, but assume that you have a city that has a budget of $100. And most of that budget is made up of levy and aid. Now, there's a little extra, but let's just assume. If you have a city that receives no local government aid, $100 is going to be levy. So in that $100 budget, they're going to be, if you use a 3% levy increase, they're going to be able to raise $3 of additional revenue. If you've got a city that has $50 levy and $50 LGA, that 3% is going to go on the $50. You're only going to be able to raise $1.50. And what happens here is that the cities that have the lowest property wealth and probably are having a more difficult time providing services, now you've even made that more difficult, because as a percent of the budget that they need, assuming these cities are equal, to provide all the necessary services, they're going to have less dollars now to add on to that, which is going to somehow impact their services. So there is a huge difference when you do that. And you're going to really, to me, it's piling on the poorer cities and the cities that need local government aid. I'll just make one other point, because we talked about this the other day quite a bit, is that if you also have a city that would happen to get some significant business, new businesses to come in that would really increase the tax capacity, they're now going to lose local government aid. And there's no way in this plan where they could make that up. So in fact, let's go back to your $100 budget. And the city that had LGA of 50 and levy of 50, because of significant property tax base increase, maybe their LGA goes down now to $45 instead of 50. And now you only go a dollar. They'll actually have less revenue to work with under these levy limits than they did the year before. And yet, they've got all this new expansion in tax capacity, and they now need, you know, maybe more police, more street, more fire, and you've got a real death spiral going on for some of those small cities that they're not going to be able to provide those services. Residents now, why stay here? We're going to leave. That increases property taxes for the residents that stay. So, there's a lot of debate on this, and I just think that it's not a level playing field just by looking at levy, because the budgets are levy plus aid, and that determines the services that are being provided. But we had this discussion the other day quite a bit, but anyway.
Thank you. And I guess before public testimony, we should take a quick look at the spreadsheet so everybody's got that. And Commissioner, one thing that's not on the spreadsheet that should also be in this committee, at least as a discussion piece, the transportation bill that was passed was at its core a tax bill, and my understanding is in the governor's bill, and it's not general fund, but I believe he's unfunding some of the transit for the Met Council and sort of implicitly having a new sales tax in the metro if approved by the counties. Basically, you know, he opposed that revenue, and now he's using it to spend it on other things, and I think that discussion needs to take place in this room too. And I don't know if you have any information on that so we can all look at that, but that's certainly a tax policy issue, and if you want to comment on that, then we could go through the spreadsheet, but I think we need to take a look at that, so maybe next time you're here, we could see how that flows.
Point well taken. It certainly falls in the purview of this committee, so I will get up to you all the information we have about that, whatever time you want to come back and talk about that.
Okay, and I'm sure people like Representative Earhart will have a lot of thoughts on that policy as well. So, Commissioner, to the spreadsheet then, if you could.
Okay. First off, the two, it's the individual income tax. Now, the subtraction, now what's remaining here is the subtraction for National Guard training outside of Minnesota. We passed something in House File 3201. This is the retroactive piece of that. So, that's one part we did not pass in 3201. This will make it retroactive to that 1105 date. because that cost $405,000 one time. The pension, we talked about the military pension, military pay subtraction, a little over $11 million in the first year in 2010, and $17 million in 2011. The regional emerging business investment tax credit is capped at $3 million total, one-time appropriation. Foreign operating corporation, $102 million in the FY09, $80.5 million in 2010, and $83.6 million in 2011. The mutual fund provider, personal change that we talked about, would be a loss of revenue of $600,000 in 2009, 2.1 in 2010, and 2.2 in 2011. The reduction in sales tax from 6.5 to 6.375. We had about $76.8 million in the first year, 87.5 in 2010, and 90.5, almost 90.6, 2011. Of course, the lottery in lieu of sales tax there also, that's relatively de minimis. The increase in the accelerated payments from 80 to 85%. Now, does this number include that, the point from 83 to 80, or 81 to 85?
No, this is just from 80 to 85.
This is 80 to 85.
80 to 85. Mm-hmm.
Okay, okay. Job B tax benefits, extension of those districts from year 10 to 12 years, $300,000 in FY09, $900,000 in 10, $1.8 million in 2011. The elimination of the political contribution refund generates $5.4 million in 2009, $5.7 million, 2010, and $6.8 million in 2011. Property tax gains and credits, biggest number in there by far is the renters, the reduction in the percent in the renters credit from 19 to 16, $33.6 million in 2010 and $34 million. That raises in 2011, so it's about $11 million for each percent that you reduce that renter's credit. We also make the mobile home renter's credit consistent with that, and you see that generates a little bit of revenue, $230,000 in 2010 and $250,000 in 2011. The next line is the utility transition aid, which we discussed, $760,000 appropriation in 2010 and $1.53 in 2011. The property tax limits do have impact on the property tax refund, and that generates about $4.8 million a year in reduction in property tax refunds. The next line is the accelerated payment for tobacco and cigarettes. You see that's $980,000 in 2009. And once again, the reducing the rates in the lottery and sales flu in lieu of sales tax, $180,000 per year, $200,000 in 2010 and $2,000 in 2011. I don't know if I need to go through the rest of all. The rest of just reducing the rates from at 6.5 to 6.375. You see that that does not impact motor vehicle sales tax. No impact there.
Okay, thank you for that. Thank you for that. And we're going to go to testifiers then so we can make sure we get them in before the next committee has to come in. And I have first Nan Madden, followed by Bradley Peterson, and then Mara Humphrey. So if Nan Madden wants to come up, Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I have Jessica Webster with you?
Sure.
I am the same.
Welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. The Minnesota Budget Project is an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We provide independent research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues, with particular attention to the impact that fiscal decisions have on low and moderate income Minnesotans. I would like to testify today in strong opposition to the cuts to the renter's credit that are included in the governor's budget proposal. We think this proposal is unfair and would increase the regressivity of our tax system. The renter's credit provides a reduction in property taxes for over 271,000 moderate and low-income Minnesota households whose rents are high in relation to their income. Seniors and persons with disabilities make up 29% of all renter's credit recipients. And in 13 counties in greater Minnesota, at least one-half of households receiving the renter's credit include seniors or people with severe disabilities. The governor's proposal would cut the renter's credit by over 20% or $68 million in the next biennial. I think in looking at the renter's credit, the crucial question is whether it is doing what it's supposed to be doing, which is reducing the regressivity of the state's property tax system. Rental property taxes are among the most regressive taxes in the state. After the renter's credit offsets a portion of those property taxes for people whose housing costs are particularly high, the regressivity is reduced, but still rental property taxes remain more regressive than nearly all other tax types. If anything, that points to a need to strengthen the renter's credit rather than cut it. I know there's been some discussion about the calculation of the renter's credit and what percentage of rent is considered the renter's share, but I think we're focusing on that piece and missing the larger picture, which is what is the ultimate impact on the regressivity of the system. But just to talk about that issue a little bit, I'm not sure that it's clear that the tax reductions that went to rental properties in 2001 were passed on to renters. And from my discussion with former Representative Andy Dawkins and others who were around when they changed the properties, the renter's credit to a straight percentage of rent, that was done at that time to protect renters at a time that rental property taxes were going down. It was thought that that benefit would not be passed on to renters, so that renters did not see a cut in their renter's credit as a result. I'm also not clear that the figures that Department of Revenue found for 2004 still apply to 2008, which is what this proposal would do. There's been a lot of changes in the market since then. So even if those numbers are correct for 2004, I'm not sure it makes sense to apply them in 2008. And I just, again, want to remind you that piece of that formula is just one piece of the formula. There's also a co-payment amount. There's other parts of the calculations of the renter's credit. So I think if we want to fix that percentage of rent that's considered property taxes, we should look at a revenue-neutral proposal that takes care of that piece but still has an end result that reduces the regressivity of the property tax, which, again, even after the renter's credit we have now, rental property taxes is one of the most regressive taxes that we have. In addition, we're concerned that the governor's supplemental budget relies on low-income people, persons with disabilities, the elderly, and other vulnerable populations to play a disproportionate role in helping solve the state's budget deficit. So we're really disappointed to see this proposal come forward again. We saw a similar proposal in 2005, and at that time, there was a coalition of over 160 organizations across the state representing various communities, including low-income families, seniors, persons with disabilities, victims of domestic violence, and others, who united in opposition to cuts to the renter's credit. The legislature rejected the governor's proposal to cut the renter's credit in 2005, and we urge you to reject it again this year. And I do have copies for the committee of a fact sheet that shows for each county who receives the renter's credit.
Thank you for that. Paige, we'll pass it out to you.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm with Legal Aid. Legal Aid provides free legal assistance to thousands of low-income Minnesotans across the state. Very briefly, I just really have three concerns to share that echo Nan's sentiments. The first is that low-income renters across the state in the mortgage foreclosure crisis have really been innocent victims, and we've got thousands of renters that are going to lose their housing or have lost their housing, perhaps their security deposit. Have to come up with a first month's rent. Now they're going into an apartment, and we're essentially kicking them when they're down by cutting their renter's credit, and it's just adding insult to injury. The second concern I have is with our weakening economy, with rising unemployment, with rising costs, cutting the renter's credit does represent a significant hardship to these families. And finally, we just think, as Nan said, we think it's profoundly unfair to turn to the people that are least able to afford it to help balance the budget and solve budget shortfalls. And so for those reasons, we really hope that this committee is thoughtful about this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And thank you, Ms. Madden, as well. Thank you. Mr. Peterson, Utility City. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bradley Peterson with the firm of Flaherty and Hood, representing the Coalition of Utility Cities. I do have a handout as well. We appreciate the efforts of the administration to create, as Commissioner Innes puts it, a shock absorber for these cities that are taking the hit as a result of the department's rule change. But it is, in our opinion, an inadequate solution. Transition aid only compensates a handful of cities and towns, while dozens of cities, towns, counties, and school districts are taking significant hits to their property tax base and will see no relief. One example of this is the city of Granite Falls, who, despite taking a 4.8% hit on their property tax base, will see not $1 in transition aid. Changing the class rate, as we've proposed in the past, solves the problem for everyone. Transition aid is only temporary. Despite the fact that the Department of Rule Change creates something like $34 million tax shift every year, the administration's solution only attempts to soften the impact for 2 years. Changing the class rate solves the problem permanently. Finally, there's no guarantee in uncertain times that the aid will even be there for cities in 2010, as I think we've seen in the experience of LGA and other aids. What can be given can be taken away, and we don't know what the financial situation in a couple of years is going to look like. Changing the class rate solves the problem without requiring the state to spend any money. The change in class rate remains the most comprehensive and fair way to solve the problem created by the utility valuation rule change. As has been noted before, utility property is the only class of property that has seen a reduction since 2002. Giving cities transition aid rather than changing the class rate simply continues the pattern of shifting property taxes from utilities onto homeowners and businesses. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And I think if it's all right with members, we'll just go through all the testimony and then we'll have questions on anything. We have Mara Humphrey from the credit unions, followed by Jen O'Rourke, Gary Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Mara Humphrey. I'm Vice President, Governmental Affairs of the Minnesota Credit Union Network. We represent the state's 162 credit unions. And I'm here today to express concerns and to testify against the Department of Revenue's data match proposal in the tax bill. We have concerns about the additional burden that this proposal is going to place on credit unions. Specifically, we have some concerns about the logistical aspects of how this technical aspects about how this will work, especially the ability of some of our smaller credit unions to be able to comply with this. And I appreciate the department's willingness to work with us on that issue. However, we also have some broader concerns regarding the potential liability for credit unions and some privacy concerns with credit unions sharing and exchanging this account information with the department. Another concern that we have about the proposal is the cost for credit unions to comply. Credit unions or data processors will need to be able to run the matches, and from my understanding, from what I've been able to gather from credit unions, it's going to be expensive startup costs since this program will only be in Minnesota, and it's not nationwide like the Child Support Program. One mid-sized credit union estimated to me that it's going to cost somewhere around $5,000 to get their data processor to set up the program to run the matches, and then each time that they run it, a couple hundred will be charged to them, and the $150 that's proposed for reimbursement in the bill does not cover those costs. So thank you for listening. I just wanted to share some of our concerns with that proposal. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Ms. O'Rourke or Mr. Carlson or both, who's ever here? Welcome, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'll be brief, and I'll highlight three pieces of the bill. One that we do support, actually, are the changes made to the Job Z duration limits and the targeted rural opportunity communities. We think those would be good changes to the law, and we did support the resetting of the clock provision last year that was in the final tax bill that was vetoed by the governor. We do have, I guess the testimony on my other two pieces actually has already been expressed by Representative Wolfschlager and Representative Marquardt, but I'll go ahead and repeat it. We do support a more permanent fix to the utility transition problem, or utility tax base loss problem, be that an aid program that's more permanent that would more effectively cover the cost or the loss tax base for those cities, or a class rate change as indicated by Mr. Peterson. But the League of Minnesota Cities as a statewide organization did adopt a policy in support of a more permanent fix to those host communities' predicament. And then finally, it should be of no surprise to you all that we do strongly oppose generally the idea of levy limits, and specifically the proposal that is included in the tax bill here. Representative Marquardt expressed some of the problems, or most of the problems, with that already. Let me just say one other thing that I will hear from my cities as they try to struggle with those levy limits. They will call me up and say, you know, we were really frugal over the last couple of years. We knew that we couldn't raise taxes on our taxpayers, and now because of that frugality, we are going to be penalized moving forward because we will have a levy increase based upon a much lower levy base amount. So we do strongly oppose the levy limits. One other comment I would like to leave on that, though, the LGA program still does redistribute LGA, and some cities will see increases and some cities will see decreases in LGA, and this levy limit proposal will not accommodate those cities that do lose LGA. I think Representative Marquardt actually mentioned that, but that's an important piece, and some cities have seen quite a bit of volatility in that LGA distribution. Part of that is taken care of in the first tax bill, but it is something to pay attention to as you look at levy limits. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And again, we just want to get through all the public testifiers, and then we can ask questions. Mr. Zamboy, Metro City. Is he here? Yes. Thank you. And then it's Keith Carlson and Joe Matthews and David Skillbred. Okay, Mr. Zamboy, Metro City. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, my name is Louis Jamboy. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We are an organization that has 86 city members in the 7-county metro area, and that includes the core cities, the fully developed suburbs, the developing suburbs, and several cities on the urban fringe. We know that the legislature and the governor have a very difficult task ahead to try to address the state budget deficit. And we appreciate the fact that the governor didn't include cuts to LGA or market value homestead credit in his proposal. We would, however, like to talk today about the levy limit side of his proposal. We, as every other municipal organization does, oppose those limits. Local control is a fundamental principle of our organization, and our local elected officials are accountable to the citizens they represent to create balance between taxation and service levels. And we think that that a levy limit program is a very blunt instrument that may not reflect the actual relationship between the local elected officials and the residents. And as with everyone else, we think the governor's proposal is structured really adversely affects the property poor cities, and we oppose that as well. We think that property taxes are the main vehicle in which cities finance basic services like sewer and water, safe streets, police and fire protection, and that these are services that provide the foundation for our economic vitality and upon which we all run and depend on for our lives. The cities provide these services very reliably and efficiently, and we don't think that they should be changed with a levy limit proposal. Our policies support the state's property tax refund program, and I know that hasn't been a topic of conversation today, but we liked last year's House proposal, which beefed up the property tax refund program. We would like to see it back again. We think it is a good way of connecting property tax relief with the ability to pay in those cities that do not receive any LGA, and several of our member cities do not. So with that, Madam Chair, I will quit. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you.
and Mr. Matthews, I guess, jointly. That's nice. We appreciate that. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the interest of time, I'll be fairly brief. I'm Joe Matthews of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I've given a handout that they're distributing, and I just wanted to point out a few facts on the levy limit issue, which AMC strongly opposes. Counties have had fairly flat revenues if you adjust for inflation over the last 10 years. And the front page you'll see in the handout is actually a graph from the State Auditor's Office that shows you the difference between actual dollars collected in revenue and also the inflation-adjusted dollars. And you can see, as of 2005, we're at the same point we were at in 1999. And so counties are already struggling with a lack of revenues, despite the fact our property tax levies have gone up. Our overall revenues, when you factor in aids and everything else, are actually relatively stagnant.
Thank you.
I'd also like to point out, this is actually something courtesy of Jeff Van Wyk in the second chart. It shows you, if you factor in growth, along with inflation in our revenues on a per capita basis, we're actually down about 12.6% since 2003. The state, if you net away the aids that are the revenues that are passed through to cities and counties and schools, the state is actually up 5.9% in revenue per capita. And we thought that was an important point to cut, important issue to point out, that we're doing our best to maintain a responsible budget. And then also, the governor's plan, the levy limits, do not take into account a number of factors that are driving our county budgets at this point. And I guess the real issue for us is, it's not one of why are we raising property taxes or why are we doing it, but what can the state do to help us rein in some of those costs? And as I already mentioned, there are some issues coming up this year with the budget that are going to really put a crunch on counties. One is short-term offenders. Another is the fact that federal funds for taking care of children who are in abusive homes, that money is being cut to the tune of $80 to $100 million, and counties will be picking up the tab for that. And also, I won't read all these off, but health care costs for counties have been skyrocketing. Cass County said 24%, Dodge 18%, Freeborn 13.8%, Lincoln County 38%, Lyon County 24%, Monoma County 25%. I could keep going, but the point is, that's an issue that this doesn't recognize the fact that we have costs as employers that we're picking up that are not tied to inflation, and that will not be adequate. Also, another issue that I would be remiss in not mentioning is the fact that our public safety costs right now are being driven by jail construction. That's a mandate that comes down to the Department of Corrections. I know Representative Walschlager had this issue in her county. Wabasha County's levy went up 16% only on the jail issue. It went up even more than that to pay for other costs of government. That's a huge cost driver that we aren't able to manage. I know that there's an exception for bonding, but the last chart I handed out is also from the state auditor that shows the level of indebtedness for counties. As you can see, it's growing, adjusted for inflation or not, and we think that's a real concern going forward. Some counties do not bond for projects. Cass, Chippewa, Houston, Coochiching, Lacaparra, Lake of the Woods, Mauer, Norman, Red Lake, Redwood, Roseau, Stevens, and Wagena counties do not bond. And so for them, they're going to actually have to go from doing kind of a pay-as-you-go, which they believe is best for their taxpayers, to borrowing, which will cost more in the long term. And with that, I'll end my testimony, and I'll answer any questions if there are.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Matthews. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I've had two documents passed out, and I just quickly will go run through them. The first of those is issues facing counties in 2008-2009. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure that the county appreciates the situation that counties find themselves in coming into this session. Like cities, our general purpose aid, which is called program aid, is at a level less than we were certified in 2003. But in addition, there were a number of cuts in other areas of the budget that are still in place today or having to cope with, was either reducing costs or expenditures in other areas or increasing our property tax levies. I won't go into detail as to what those are. I also want to make sure that the committee realizes, although we got some money in the Health and Human Services bill to offset some of the federal cuts that Mr. Matthews made reference to, those monies were temporary and essentially have already been spent, and the costs or losses that we're suffering at the federal level are ongoing and will be a major cost driver for us in the future. Finally, an area that's relatively unique for the counties is mandates, and these aren't a one-time event. Last year alone, over $20 million of additional costs were placed on counties as a result of the actions of the legislature asking us to provide new services, which in some instances, such as the Family Stabilization Program, which were previously hard to place in-job MFIP recipients are going to raise our costs substantially on a permanent basis. With specific regard to the governor's budget, Mr. Matthews has already covered that major provision affecting us in the tax bill, but I want to again acquaint the committee with the fact that much of what is affecting counties in the governor's budget recs are not in the tax bill, but are in the Health and Human Services bill, the Corrections bill, or public safety. And I've basically broken this down by those that have direct impacts on counties. In some instances, they affect all counties, such as the repeal of the increase in the short-term offender subsidy, which was going to go from a $9 per day subsidy to about $30 a day. The governor takes this back to $9 for offenders that cost us from $60 to $100 a day. Going on to page two, a number of provisions that only affect some counties has operators of nursing homes or hospitals or direct providers of chemical dependency services, and you'll see those are a substantial area. Yeah. And finally, there are areas that on page four that are indirect in their effect on us and basically cutbacks in healthcare expenditures that will affect the clients we serve, such as through the elimination of transitional medical assistance to children who no longer qualify for Medicaid. Those costs will come back to us in terms of expenditures for uncompensated care, particularly for those counties that directly operate hospital or clinics. And with that, I'll end my testimony. Again, be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that. We have Mr. Skilbud and Mr. Stephen Johnson. And that's all I have. And anyone else from the public who would like to give us any testimony or have any questions? Mr. David Skilbud. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Correct, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. David Skilbud, Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. Okay. I'd just like to share a few brief concerns about Section 1 regarding the bank data match section of the bill. Number one, when we looked at this, we thought it was perhaps not too controversial for us because it's built on the child support data match. The more we look into it, though, the more we see these as two very different programs and the more complicated and concerned we get with the bank data match proposal. For example, and as Ms. Humphrey testified, this is going to be a separate electronic format that will have to be built into the core systems at each of our institutions. Those will vary on their ability to do that, and it'll vary on the ability for the cost. So the bank data match system will be a separate system which will need to be recognized by each institution, and the cost to implement that will be substantial on the first time, along with cost to continue running it. Secondly, some privacy issues. The child support data match, it's our understanding that this is a national program and that the National Law Rights to Financial Privacy Act exempts the relay of personal information to implement that program. No such exemption that we are aware of applies to this sort of program for this purpose. Finally, I've been trying to get a hold of some other bank associations in other states because it was alluded that this is a program that some other states are doing. The one that I was able to get a hold of was Indiana. In that instance, the banks in Indiana do not scrub the names themselves. Rather, they provide the names to the state, and then the state scrubs the names looking for two things: a match either for the child support data match or a match for the delinquent taxes. And so that's a very different system than the one being proposed in this bill. And secondly, that system is more similar to the understanding of how we do our child support data match in Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Steve Johnson, Director of Government Relations, Minnesota Bankers Association, representing 95% of the banks in Minnesota, large and small across the state, about 440 members. And I'll be very brief. My comments are very similar to what Ms. Humphrey and Mr. Skilbred mentioned. The child support being a national program, this being a just in a few states, we think it'd be very easy for a tax debtor to move their account to another state and not capture that information. There is a cost, which is estimated by some of my members, it'd be cost anywhere from $2,300 to $5,000 to put this program in place, and with ongoing cost of anywhere from $465 to $800, and that's sort of small and medium-sized financial institutions. The Department of Revenue does provide some reimbursement, but it probably wouldn't cover that. So, and then there are some privacy and liability concerns. So in summary, those are our issues with this and concerns. And the department has been working with us. We really appreciate that. But at this time, we do not support that position. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm through with the testifiers. Is there anyone else in the public who wanted to testify? And if there, yes, please, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, which is the new trade association representing life insurance companies. And we also wanted to comment on Section 1, the Financial Institution Data Match. And we have similar administrative concerns to the others that testified before on the section, although we have some slightly different concerns based on the fact that we're not banks, we're life insurers, so we have a different product. And our concern is compared to the child support data match program, the definition of what a count is in this program is significantly broader, and it includes any funds or property held. And for an insurance company, that could be an incredibly broad array of items, anything from disability insurance and long-term care insurance, benefit payments, the cash or surrender or loan value of a life insurance or annuity policy, or even the life proceeds that would go to a beneficiary. So we have great concerns about the breadth of the program. It certainly seems to be broader to us than the other programs that are around. And there's also, in our view, some public policy issues in terms of most of the products that we offer are for the benefit of someone other than the insured or who the debtor would be, and that's another big concern that we have. And we have talked to the Department of Revenue, and they are willing to talk to us, but at this time we oppose that provision.
Okay, thank you for that, Ms. Rowan. Anyone else in the public who would like to testify either for or against any provisions in this bill? Okay, if not, are there other questions? There are not. We're going to represent our heart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if anybody from the commissioner's office is still here.
Yes, they're still here.
Well, my question is, if we adopt the governor's proposal in tax year, we balance for this biennium, what does it do to the next biennium?
Yes, Ryan.
Well, I can only speak to the tax piece. I see Tom Hansen here, Commissioner Hansen here, to talk about the long-term out of biennium. I wouldn't be able to comment on that.
Okay. Thank you for your question, Representative Earhart. We'll have to get Commissioner Hansen in here. Members, we're going to meet tomorrow and Wednesday. We're going to lay over Representative Simpson's bill on who he offered on behalf of the governor, and we'll be continuing to discuss all of these provisions. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.